sense of this this text, especially here in this part. Now, this is like most of John in their teachings. It is extremely dangerous. And what I mean by extremely dangerous, misunderstood or misapplied. Bye, Jojo. When these things are misapplied or applied without any judgment, without wisdom, it has disastrous effects. First of all, most people that do not have wisdom approach this and they see these types of teachings and they understand them to be, they take them from a nihilistic point of view. Meaning, they can do whatever they want. Like all bets are off. It's a ticket for a free ride. You can do anything you want with it. But that's not what the text means. When it says that you hold no idea about what's right and what's wrong. That's not what it's talking about. Although, from a wisdom perspective, that is what they're talking about. So when we approach this text, and this is one of the ways to control, maybe control some of the damage that can be done with misunderstanding. The first thing we have to do when we approach these types of dangerous texts is to remember that this is a Prajnaparamita text. It's the highest wisdom sutra, or talk, or teaching. And it comes from what turning? Anyone know? What school?
Mahayana.
Yes, it's a Mahayana text. Mahayana text, which again, Mahayana is not so great a word, because it's not very clear. Yeah, great vehicle. What does that really mean? It means Bodhisattvayana. It means the Bodhisattva vehicle, because there is no other approach to Mahayana. It has to be Bodhisattva. If there's no Bodhisattva, it's not Mahayana. So I don't know why they just don't call it Bodhisattvayana. I mean, some groups do, and I think that's a more appropriate name. It's a better name. Because there's no such thing as any form of Mahayana practice that is not related to the Bodhisattva path. So, if this is a text from the Bodhisattva vehicle, we immediately have to be made aware that this is founded on two things. The people in class last night aren't allowed to answer because They know this because we went over it again last night. Two things have to be brought to mind before we even attempt to study this text. Number one is that our mind must be focused on the path itself. And the way to do that is the four thoughts that turn the mind to Dharma. So we immediately need to recall the four thoughts. Or any one of the four thoughts that really gets you lit on fire. Hopefully you know what those are. If you don't, spend this week committing yourself to memorizing the four thoughts that turn the mind. Because Buddha said they're the most important thing to make you actually practice. The preciousness of human rebirth. You have absolutely no guarantee whatsoever that you're ever going to get to do this again. Sure, Buddhism likes to talk about, oh, the next life. That next life could be 9 million years from now. You could be going through all kinds of, I mean, just thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of lifetimes as something other than this precious human life. You could be the deer who gets stuck in the headlights and gets hit by the car. You could be the deer that gets shot by the hunter. You could be the worm that gets placed on a hook for a fisherman. You can be anything and everything other than this precious human rebirth. You could even be that single cell thing that swims around in a mud puddle in Thailand. So the Buddha says, to obtain this specific type of life is exceedingly difficult. It's like trying to find a needle within 25,000 haystacks. It'd take you a very long time to find that, locate that one needle. Which means, this is your shot. This is your moment to make something. To really generate great karma, merit, and virtue, and all this kind of stuff, because you have all the faculties right now. But another thought that turns the mind towards Dharma is, right now, you have this precious human rebirth, but how long do you get to be here? You see, the time of the enemy is unknown. It's uncertain. You have no idea when this is going to come to an end. When your alarm clock is going to go off and this dream is over. Could be in a couple of weeks, could be in the next 5 minutes. Could be 10 years from now. You have no idea and zero guarantee. Which means you have to really take a look at what's taking up your time. What is it that you're doing? Another thought is that suffering is just everywhere. It's a constant. You know, Buddha says, no matter what you do, you're going to have problems. You buy a house, you have house problems. Buy a car, have car problems. Get in a relationship, you have relationship problems. You have money, you have money problems. You have no money, you have poverty problems. You always have a problem, no matter what it is that you have or don't have. You have a related problem. And that's just the system of suffering. This samsaric place. This Saha world. In order to escape that and escape the negative influence that it has on us, we need to engage Dharma. And another one of the four thoughts is the impermanence of everything. The absolute impermanence of all of it. If absolutely nothing is going to last, the only thing you can do is build on Dharma. You know, in Christianity they say, well, you can't take anything with you here, so you should do all the practices that build mansions in the sky. Well, yeah, that's Buddhist concept. Is do everything here and now in order to create the better rebirth, the better conditions, and the potential to have the leisure to practice Dharma, to find a teacher, to be in a realm where there are the Dharma texts, and so on and so forth. Because everything else is impermanent. So those are the four thoughts that lead us to, turns our mind towards Dharma, makes us actually think about in a very careful way the Dharma. And then once we start thinking about Dharma, we on the Bodhisattva path, the Mahayana path, base everything on twofold bodhicitta. Anyone been through Lojong class knows all about twofold bodhicitta. So when you have these two pillars in place, you can then turn to this text and you can say, okay, we're not to remain in a dualistic state, and we are supposed to be incredibly careful to not engage in it. We're not even supposed to put ourselves in a position where we are having to judge or uphold a dualistic principle. This is avoid the pursuit carefully. If there's even the trace of this or that, right or wrong, the mind's essence will be lost in confusion. In the Bodhisattva class, we come up with some, we're faced with some very difficult concepts, very challenging ideas. For example, we're always taught, well, you know, anger and violence is very negative, totally horrible thing. Creates lots of negative karma. It's very bad for society, for the individual, for those that are abused by it, and so on and so forth. And then historically, every single Dharma master out there has been that to their disciples. I personally do not know of any teacher, living or otherwise, I honestly do not know any teachers, including all of my own, that have not suffered the wrath of their own gurus, their own teachers. None. I mean, most of my teachers have stories of intense abuse. Like we privileged people in America would say, well, I'm going to go call the police, or I'm going to go get a lawyer, because this is uncalled for and unnecessary. But in Asia, this is how Dharma is transmitted. It has been for centuries. And immediately, and hopefully your minds are already doing the dualistic thing right now as I'm telling you this. You're putting up a whole judgment of what's right and what's wrong. That's exactly what he's talking about. He's not talking about whether it's okay to go rob a bank or be mean to your neighbor. He's talking about when outer sense data comes in contact with your ear or your eye or your nose or your tongue or your sense of touch, or a thought in your mind that you immediately pursue dualistic state. You immediately grasp or cling to this is right or this is absolutely wrong. And you jump to it right away. And he says, look what happens. The mind essence is lost in confusion. Because now, what happens when we hear about a master having been abused by his master for the sake of Dharma? Well, now we just don't know. We don't know if there's something now inherently wrong with this religion that we picked. Is that some kind of a cult that they were in? And not real Dharma? Am I not in real Dharma if I'm not being hit with sticks like all the other masters were before me? All of a sudden, our mind is all over the place. It's drumming up all kinds of stories. Oh, well, maybe the Dharma should be totally changed for the West. Maybe it shouldn't be changed and somehow a blah, 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 blah. And our mind has no calm or quiet. It's just all over the place. Trying to figure out the right angle to either make, well, yeah, okay, so for their culture it was right, but it's not right for our culture. Really? Because we're talking about a lot of cultures. Indian, Southeast Asian, North Asian, East Asian, Central Asian. All these people, they are not the same people. Some of these people are incredibly gentle people. Socially and historically. We end up getting the crap beat out of them by some lunatic Indian master who decides to go and propagate Dharma to them. Takes a stick, answer this question. They go, I don't know. Bang! And they get hit with a stick. And it's like, holy cow, what kind of... How's that Dharma? You see? And the mind goes nuts. This is an easy topic. Think about how every other element that we come in contact with, this happens. Especially right now. Since we're all living in the West, if you pay any attention to news media, you get a ton of this stuff. They're constantly feeding you. Oh, so-and-so did this evil thing. So-and-so did this really great thing. So-and-so did this. We're not sure if it's evil or not yet. And it causes us to engage in these pursuits. Because the next thing we want to do is have a talk show about what the news was. Let's discuss this and call in and discuss what we think of this thing. It's totally ridiculous. And our mind essence goes crazy. Because as soon as we run into somebody that has a different view than ours, it all goes to hell. It's all ruined. Now all of a sudden we're disturbed again. We're disturbed because our opinion was right because everybody on the radio agreed with us, and that guy is wrong. Or all of a sudden, maybe that guy has better facts than us, and we're stuck wondering, well, how in the world can I be wrong? Here's the trick. All of these dualistic ideas, all of the judging, all of the concepts, basically, all of this lumped together is called Lakshana. All the stories that you drum up and the stuff that you hear, all of it, everything, even the person presenting it on the radio or the TV, whatever kind of media you use, computers, even all of that, all comes from one place, your mind. It's like the mind is a garden, and everything is growing up in this garden. It's not even really a garden. It's just your yard. And in your mind's eye, you perceive, I like the look of that plant, so it's not a weed. I don't like this plant because of the way it smells or it looks or it tastes. I'm going to call that one a weed. But it's all growing out of the same plot of earth. And all of it is essentially nothing other than plant life. It is nothing more than a reflection or a manifestation of the living life energy of planet Earth. And we decide to make weed killers to kill certain aspects of that life. And to promote more of another aspect of that life. But it all is just life. All of the things that arise for you to be able to hear, taste, smell, touch. I mean, I keep saying that over and over and over because I don't think we're understanding it. Your experiences are only coming through these gates. It does not exist anywhere else, and it is only the mind that interprets all of this information. It doesn't come from anywhere else. It doesn't arise in any other way. It's not collected by any other method. And it's not even understood by you by any other way than your mind. And so the mind is nothing more than a mirror that's reflecting all of life's energy around you. And you choose what part of that mirror you hate, which makes no sense. And so we are stuck with this, all of this stuff, and we do not perceive that, wow, this is just awesome, because with this dualistic stuff trying to arise in the mind, the reality is it's just reflecting the life force energy of mind. It's demonstrating that I'm actually a Buddha. Because that's the sheer power of Buddha, is that everything arises equally. And nothing's judged as negative or positive. You know, planet Earth does not think earthquakes are horrible. We do. But Earth certainly doesn't. It's kind of like whenever you comb your hair, all of those little microscopic bugs that live in your hair get disturbed. But you innately don't think combing your hair is terrible. Or when they're building their little towns and cities, you know, on a certain spot of the body, and you get up and you go like this and stretch, and you just ripped apart all of their freeways, and they're like, what the, man, would you, you realize we spent millions of dollars on Department of Transportation to build this, and the ground just split and tore it all apart, just because you decided you needed to stretch. And to you, stretching felt really good. You don't think planet Earth thinks that stretching feels great? Of course it does. I mean, I don't want to get horribly gross, but I'm going to. Anybody ever lanced a zit? What do you think a volcano is? A thing under pressure. Oh, that feels great. And we're like, oh God, it's a disaster. Everything planet Earth is doing is only an expression of it being alive. Everything you are experiencing is only an expression of you being alive. Not your egoic you, but the one mind. If we are able to perceive everything arising from this mind, we can actually catch a glimpse of that mind. Now he says, you have to be unattached even to that one mind, because if you don't, you will have this concept that you have just this one mind and everything else is not. And so then you come up with all kinds of problems. You begin thinking that you yourself are God, or other kinds of weird concepts. This is a problem with Yogacharas. But this is the idea. At this point, I'm not too concerned with you guys being attached to even the one. I would prefer that you do this practice in order to experience the existence of the one. See, it did that thing again. You guys can still see me or no?
Yeah, we can still hear you.
Oh, it paused?
I don't know. What happens? It flips over to a... Let's open Pandora and...
There you go.
Yeah, it's really wacky. This machine is like going downhill very, very fast. So check this out. Just like planet Earth doing all that it does, it's not disturbed. See this next line? When the mind exists undisturbed in the way, nothing in the world can offend. And when nothing can offend, everything ceases to exist in the old way. Good and evil are totally out. High tide, low tide really doesn't matter. It's just the natural flow. Just like when a forest catches on fire and burns down, the earth is not that upset about it. It just sees that's the impermanence of those plants, and now we have space for something entirely new. And so fires are no longer deemed as an evil or a positive. And in fact, keep this in mind, fire is only a negative thing because we have invested stock in where that fire is happening. We've built houses. Planet Earth is not losing any money. Planet Earth is not losing anything in the fire. In fact, it's just creating more potential for a whole new expression. It's not disturbed. But because we live in dualistic state, we are horribly disturbed. If we can begin to watch the mind and begin to mimic or mirror the way that planet Earth exists, where everything is just seen as the natural flow of life, and we begin to see that everything we are experiencing is nothing more than just the natural flow of mind, just the basic nature of how mind works. It says we don't have discriminating thoughts. And when we're no longer discriminating, all of those problems that you previously have had no longer exist. That's what that means. When the old mind ceases to exist, it means you will not have that samsaric life. Your suffering mind vanishes. The egoic mind that is always clinging, that is attached, or that is rejecting, vanishes, and you live in a pure, undisturbed, peaceful state. That's the byproduct. So this paragraph here of the "when no discriminating thoughts arise," this is kind of a very complex Yogacharan approach to how the mind actually operates, and we're not going to get into that here because that's more of an advanced class that discusses the functioning of how mind works. So we jump down, and it says, "To live in the great ways, neither easy nor difficult, but those with the limited views are fearful and irresolute." And therein lies some more of that danger. They don't know how to let themselves mimic or be a reflection to or like the earth, and letting the mind just naturally flow. They're still stuck on that issue of having to judge, having to set up this dualistic thing. They're still in that pursuit. Because they're in that pursuit, they're fearful of whether what they're doing is right or wrong. They have all kinds of, another way to say that they're unsure of everything. They have a tremendous amount of confusion. We see this a lot in Dharma. Students will see something in a Dharma center or from a teacher or something like that, and then they think, oh, well, maybe this isn't really my community. I need to go somewhere else. I need to do something different. And that they're confused on what's going on. What was once the best place for them now all of a sudden isn't, and they don't really know what to do, and maybe they should do something else. And all of a sudden, their minds are all over the place. Which is another thing that is, this is another side note, just to show you how the West not only should become the new center for Dharma, but at the same time is also the leading cause of its demise. Because traditionally, no one was ever allowed to leave a community without express permission. You couldn't just go, oh, that's it, I'm going to go to this temple now. It didn't work that way. You would have to go, whoever gave you refuge, and say, Gray the Master, I want to go attend another community. You were not allowed to just leave. You couldn't just be like, all right, Shakyamuni, I'm out of here. You'd have to go to him and say, can I have permission to go study with Vimalakirti instead? But in the West, we have these crazy ideas that we can do whatever we want, we can go wherever we want, we can change our political party at any time just by signing the little card. But Dharma is not that way. It doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way because Dharma is always trying to get you to recognize this point, that you get stuck on dualistic view. And you have to sit. You literally have to sit in that moment of despair, of confusion, of fear. As the text says, being irresolute. You have to sit in that. And hopefully the people, the teacher or whoever it is skillful enough to let you almost ground in it before putting the stick down in there, or you learn to swim. Because it's kind of like that. They just throw you in the pool and then they just watch. Usually we say, oh, well, they threw me in the pool. I gulped too much water and was coughing and choking, and I found my way to the out of the pool, and that's it. I'm going to a different pool. I'm not going to work with them. But the next pool should do the exact same thing to you. Or they're not teaching you anything. This isn't academia. This is not read and try and understand in the mind. This is jump out of the plane and have the experience of parachuting. No direct immediate experience, no enlightenment. That's it. It's not about discussing the pH levels of the pool. If it's clean or not, did somebody pee in it or not, when was the last time it was cleaned, how many people are going to be in it, when is it adults only hour, none of that stuff matters. What matters is that you get in the water, you're wet, and you're gulping down water and choking. And one of two things happen. You learn to swim, or you're about ready to drown, and the master reaches down and pulls you up, and says, let's try this again. That's it. So it says, here, the faster they hurry, the slower they go. How are they hurrying? By running around with a chicken with its head cut off. Jumping around. Different teachers, different organizations, different teachings, different books, different methods of practice, different this, different that. For those in the Vajrayana, it's different yidam, it's different tradition, different lineage, different what, and they're just all over the place. And the more they do that, the much slower they head towards enlightenment. 10 years ago when I first started teaching in St. Louis, I used to have this thing where I said all forms of Dharma are different methods of transportation. Some of them are the city bus, some of them are aircraft, some of them are helicopters, jets, bullet trains, some of them are skateboards or bicycles, but they all lead you to enlightenment. When we're doing this fearful or resolute and running around all over the place in this kind of thing, we are on foot. It is the slowest method possible. Never going to get there. Because we are overly consumed with the dualistic nature of our own mind. He even says in here, clinging cannot be limited. That's clinging to their own opinions, clinging to their own emotions, clinging to everything that they hold themselves. They're clinging to everything that is promoting or representing or reflecting their egoic state, their persona. And that, they have no control of the amount of clinging that they do. The last portion is obey the nature of things and you'll walk freely and undisturbed. When thought is in bondage, the truth is hidden. Everything's murky and unclear, and you have the burdensome practice of judging that does nothing but bring about annoyance, aggression. It brings about, just think of an argument. All the emotions that span an argument, that's what it brings. And anybody been in a really great argument with someone? Preferably someone very close to you, like a relative or a companion. Isn't it pretty exhausting at the end? Let's say you're in... Let's take one of those really long, heated arguments. We're not talking about when it's over. We're talking about after you've been in it for a long enough time that you just begin feeling exhausted. Usually we even say, I'm tired of this argument. Right? Because we're exhausted. It's exactly what we do with our minds. It's exactly what we do even in our approach to Dharma. We approach it like we're lawyers. Ooh, I didn't like that thing that guy did or he said or behaved or whatever it was. And now we put on our suit and tie and it's time to be in the courtroom to argue. And it's exhausting. And we in the West tend to use that to leave. I'm going to go somewhere else. Well, yeah, that's a real dharmic response. How many people did that? Oh, Shakyamuni, I'm out of here. I'm going back to Vishnu. Wow, there's an informed opinion. What are we doing? And he says, what benefit can actually be derived from distinction and separation? Now, everything that I've brought up, let's reflect back on how any of that stuff that we do matches with the four thoughts that lead you to practice Dharma and your twofold bodhicitta. How does any of that fit in? How does any of the going faster to slow yourself down, the running all over the place, the constant judging, the constant opinion, the constant this, the constant that, have anything to do with the four thoughts that turn the mind and upholding your twofold bodhicitta, your relative and ultimate bodhicitta, compassion? This is why I say, this text is dangerous without that as the fundamental point. Everything you are doing, always ask yourself very clearly, what does this have to do with the four thoughts? What does this have to do with upholding my vow as a bodhisattva to doing twofold bodhicitta? And it should bring everything in very clear perspective. If not, you should go to the Dharma teacher and say, this I'm confused about. Because I'm quite sure I will have plenty of human rebirths immediately after this one and so on. Which is causes me to behave like this. I also don't believe I'm going to die because I eat the right kind of smoothies. I do the right kind of asana. I do the right kind of gym time. The right kind of this diet, that diet, the Burger King diet, whatever. So I'm not going to die like Jack LaLanne never died. Anybody get that? Am I the only one old enough to know Jack LaLanne?
Is that the runner who, like, died while running of a heart attack?
No.
Oh.
He's the guy that invented all the gyms that you see today. He invented this whole idea of putting together gyms for people to come and, yeah, whatever. And the dieting and all this stuff. And, you know, he was able to, like, put a piece of metal in his mouth with a rope attached to it and drag a freaking fire truck when he was like 85 years old or what. I'll never die. And then he died. Wow. Go figure. Contemplate this. If you've been through the Bodhisattva class, hopefully that has not abandoned you. In fact, I'd encourage you to go through that text again. On your own. Make it a daily practice of reading one of those points every day. Do not lose sight of those four thoughts and the practice of twofold bodhicitta. Without it, you'll be completely lost. It's like being out to sea without a compass. Your dharma practice will be out to sea without a compass. All right.
Can we call you back, teacher?
Yep. As soon as they call us back, we're going to start in long discourses of the Buddha. We're going to start reading, like, really long
right now.
Yeah, hopefully everybody has the text. Could do the connected discourses of the Buddha, numerical discourses of the Buddha.
I uploaded those.
I love those texts, and especially this this translation. The Samadhi Sutra. Although some of this stuff, it's like, who's this Dogo Kensei guy? I don't know who that is. All right. Let's go back to our Sunday service. See what kind of stuff we got going on in there.